I think framed Raldaga's God is a giant chess computer who, with the wrong moves for the opponent programmed in. Which is actually true, right? Because Raldaga says that God knows what would have happened in the world had there not been free will. It's a very strange notion. It's a very strange notion. Because you have to, so that's how he solves the problem of God's knowledge changing as the world changes. You can't have an unchanging God with unchanging knowledge if it's free will, because then God has to know new things he didn't know before. So rather than give up free will, he gives up knowledge. Right, you have to make the choice. So we have three levels of the question. We have the question of on the narrow issue is between them, whose reading of the sources do we find most compelling? We have a second question, which is on the broad conceptions of halacha, whose reading, right, whose understanding we find more compelling. There's a sort of mid-range question, which is on the narrow philosophic question that Zevin framed, which is, do you own your body or not? Who do we find more compelling? And then all we have to ask is, does this have real nafkaminas for our conception, for our understanding of informed consent? Because what we've done is, Dr. Steinberg brought this into the question of informed consent, right? He said that informed consent is unimportant because Jews believe that God owns your body, not you, right? And he acknowledged, Rosh Hashanah Israeli disagrees, and he says that God does. He said that you really do own your body. Although now it seems qualified that you really, at least non-Jews really own their body. Yeah. You have some ownership in your body, right? Jews have some ownership in their body, and non-Jews have total ownership of their body. But it turns out that that dispute is actually itself enmeshed in this huge controversy about what the nature of Torah is. And the question is, do we really want to end up saying that the question of whether or not we require informed consent in medical context depends on our broad conception of the nature of Torah. That we could say that it just stems from first principles. But that's a big claim. That's a very big claim. It also has to, to me, we have to address the question of whether. Okay, so here we have to bring in one other question. Let's frame it this way. I was going to do this through a Baruch Brody article, but I'll mention it now. Practically, right? So David wants to suggest we require informed consent for Jews and not for non-Jews. Such an assertion invalidates us as part of the conversation about how to run American medical practice. Because, right? The premise of American medical practice, for that matter Israeli medical practice, or any medical practice in a non-halachic state, is that you have to come up with a law which does not distinguish by ethnicity. Right? That's the universe we live in. So to come up with a system which distinguishes between Jews and non-Jews means that our conversation is fundamentally irrelevant to anything that could happen. Any doctor trying to implement this, right, would probably legitimately be sued. Right? Any attempt to legislate in America would be unconstitutional, and likely in Israel, right, would be whatever we call it, unbarakial, right? So are we comfortable saying, well, you know what? So what? That's what halacha says. And if halacha makes, and if the halacha cannot deal with the world as we live in it because the world as we live in it does not allow distinctions between Jews and non-Jews, so be it. Right? But that's a price to pay. That's a real price to pay. Okay, yes, Roy.
I mean, I think that intuitively what David says doesn't make sense because, makes sense that the law, regarding this, the law might be different for Jews versus non-Jews. I don't think this invalidates from the conversation, it might cause problems for Jewish doctors, but for Jewish patients, if you're an observant Jewish patient, you would just, waive your consent. You submit a waiver to the doctor and say, whatever the expert wants. And as far as I'm concerned, I know that I don't have a right to this. But, informed consent is valid, and it's something that, Goyim should have, but I don't have a right to it. I only have a right to whatever the best doctor medical opinion is.
Uh-huh. David, what do you want to say?
I'm willing to accept that as a theory. Yeah. I mean, if our stock is that giving informed consent to Jews is a violation of Lo Tamo El Dam Re'echa, then we may need to postulate that Jewish doctors need to violate the law and take whatever financial consequences are necessary.
And what should the law be? That we should, will we give informed consent or not?
Yeah, good.
We can go on another different diet for Jews. That depends how much you see yourself.
But for Jews, so they have to know internally that they're not
Uh-huh. So we argue the law should be informed consent, and we just tell Jews that you're not supposed to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
Interesting. So that works.
These are in addition to
Jewish doctors.
I mean,
Jewish patients, there's
the
level of autonomy Jewish patients have versus so with Jewish doctors, then if they're really, if this is going to be an issue, then they should just treat Jewish patients.
So we should have a, so practically, we might be able to work it out, but let's try and be part of the conversation. Okay, we're on national television now. We're having a debate, right? So, Rabbi Fried, we're having a conversation nationally whether informed consent is, in fact, an ethically useful mode of relationship between doctors and patients. Tell me what Judaism says about this. Well, Larry, I think that informed consent is a really important way of relating between Jews and between doctors and non-Jewish patients. But between doctors and Jewish patients, we really think that what's best for the patient. That the best medical interest of the patient predominates. What happens after that?
Well, see, that comes to the question of what do I see my role in American politics? Is my role to make things as good for America as possible,
uh-huh.
or is my role to make things as good for the Jews as possible? If my role is to make things as good for America as possible, then we want the informed consent statutes, and Jewish doctors will simply have to take the consequences when they need to violate it by Jewish patients. However, if my role is to make things best for the Jews, I want no informed consent statutes. We'll tell Jewish doctors that when you're treating non-Jewish patients, what you should do is give them the informed consent, even if the law doesn't require it, so that way they won't get in trouble when treating Jewish patients.
Okay, so I'll call you in a minute, Rob. So that debate is what I understand to have been the shift in policy in Aguda on abortion between 1970 and 2000 or so, whatever. As I understand it, Aguda used to write amicus curiae, right, friend of the court briefs, opposing all abortion restrictions on the grounds that if we don't oppose all restrictions to abortion, we will end up in a situation where a Jew will be forced to, a Jew will not be allowed to perform an abortion to save the life of the mother. Right, that was the, then I think probably under the influence of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who, you know, had the fairly unique position that there was a chiyuv on Jews to educate and develop the implementation of the Sheva Mitzvot among non-Jews. Right, that's right. That was a fairly unique position. But I suspect that that had a great deal of influence. Aguda, so far as I know, right over the last decade has been writing positions the other way around, writing positions in favor of abortion restrictions, and just saying, but we strongly advocate for allowing an exception to save the life of the mother. Right, and thinking about moral responsibility for society, and then secondarily, can we preserve the rights of the Jews, as opposed to building the entire calculus around, right? How do we preserve maximal Jewish religious freedom? Okay, Rob was waiting then, Roy. Yes.
I mean, the more that we talk about this, the more and more reasonable it sounds that maybe this is totally on this broader political machlok. It seems like the question is, to what extent is this something where we think Torah should be able to say something or not? In that case, maybe the machloket here is the same as the machloket when it comes to warfare.
Okay.
To what?
To warfare.
Okay, yes, Roy.
The way you framed the question to Rabbi Fried was unfair, because we could have the same TV conversation about saving non-Jewish life on Shabbat. that would sound very good if you take, you know, the general...
No, and we don't tend to participate in broad ethical conversations about the relationship between Shabbos and life-saving. We do tend to participate in conversations about medical ethics. It may be that we should just decide that halachas, we can't participate in conversations about medical ethics, because the need to distinguish between Jews and non-Jews makes us non-players in a secular conversation. And that's possible. Right. Yes, you do.
I mean, unless we just hold that the fact that Din Dabasut Adina overrides all of these considerations anyway means that really there's really nothing for us to say, and we just do whatever.
Well, an override. The question is, do we want to contribute to what the Din Dabasut Adina is? Right? In economy, once it's decided, maybe. But right now we're debating what should the law be. Congress is debating, you know, healthcare, right? So what are the, right? So what issues matter to us in terms of healthcare, right?
Right, but once we say that according to the halacha, dina lachus adina is, you know, ipso facto fine, then it doesn't really matter. It's almost value neutral. We can decide to do whatever we want to do.
Wow. So because halacha thinks that any taxation system is enforceable, we have no concern whatsoever about whether the tax code is just?
I mean, that would seem to follow from the assumption that we think that any tax code is just.
Davar reshut does not mean morally neutral.
The quote from Blessing Thing.
Thank you. Yeah,
especially where we're trying to deal with, right, as a secular society, we're trying to point of the discourse of a secular society, maybe the halacha is supposed to...
So that's a big, right? So we can make the claim that halacha is not relevant to the discourse of a secular society, and we have no interest in making it so. Right? That's a strong claim. Right? That's a strong claim. And that when professionals come and tell us, how should I act? The answer is, we don't care.
Just don't kill anyone against their will.
unless you can establish by some means that they have in advance, right, agreed.
That's an argument I don't buy, that you can ascertain such a thing.
Aha. Uh-huh. You want individual will, you don't like social...
Okay, good. So let's bring it to the last issue. Let's bring this to the last issue. So to me, one of the locus where this conversation takes place powerfully about the individual right is the rhetoric of Matiras Malamisa. Right, what does it mean to say that we require somebody to be Matiras Malamisa in order to execute them halakhically? Right, why should that be necessary? Right, God said kill him. Right, so now we have, right, we have a halachic conception, which is some notion of hasra, or something like that, right? But the right, which could conceivably be framed not as a consent standard, but as an awareness standard, right? In other words, in order that we can only kill you if you have guilt. We can only have guilt if we know that you are in fact conscious of what you're doing. So we set up these requirements so that we, right, to create a presumption. The problem is that we don't paskin that way, right? We have a position which says Lonita Nasra El Hasin and Chogig Lemeza, the only purpose for advent, right, for Asra is to establish intent. And we paskin not that way. We say the purpose of the advance warning is so that the person can state explicitly, I am doing this so that, right, or at least with full awareness of the consequence that you will kill me.
I'm an
Askan, right? So I'm an Askan, you know, to say, so that you will kill me, sounds like you're running into the Rambam problem. Right? Although I don't know what the Rambam would hold about somebody who commits a capital crime so that they can commit suicide. Right? They want to be killed, as opposed to confessing to a crime.
Well, the Rambam don't use the part of Ashram Al-Askan, and the other one's not
allowed. The Rambam that we saw doesn't use the other one. He uses Lahasin and Chokhmezi.
He also uses the language Amanat.
It doesn't make sense in the context of the Rambam when he says it, because the Rambam says that you need to for both a Chacham and an Amaras, and then he says the Svara is Lahasin and Chokhmezi, which is the opposite of what the Gemara uses as Svara.
No, because it's not clear in the Gemara whether the argument between Yosef Yehuda and the Shitas is whether the reason for Asra is not going to show the maze or what constitutes not going to show the maze. It's clear which side of the Mahogis would almost fall down. Right, you're making an assumption how to read that Gemara, that only if it's rude the whole not going to show the maze, so the argument being, right, what does it mean the how can we show the maze?
Right, perhaps there is no one who disagrees with the Hafsim Mishogeg who made it in the Gemara. Besides it says that Tamil Chacham needs Hasra is just because we don't believe the Mitzvah that a Talmud Chacham can't ever be Peshogeg.
Well, we should look at it. The Rambam set up the following cases in Matras Malamisa. He has the primary case, which is somebody about to commit a capital crime. Let's say, right, a czar about to eat truma, you're warned. You say, don't worry, you're violating the pasuk, and he said, right, the Rambam says. Even if he says, I know I'm violating the pasuk is not enough, you have to say, al manas ken ani oseh. And that sounds very clearly like it's a standard of, I am doing this with Solo, right, with the intent of being executed for it. There's nothing else you can say about it. Strange solo.
Full awareness of the punishment.
That would be Odeani, right? The Almanas Cain is a... I don't know if there's any way to make the Almanas Cain make sense.
But the Rambam thinks there's a distinction between Odeani and Almanas Cain. Then the Rambam has two other cases. One is Rodeh, and the other is Goel Adam, is the Roteach B'Shogeg, Sheyatzah Michutz L'Ir Miklato. Now, those cases require no verbal statement. The question is, what does it mean to be matir asmo lemita because you attack somebody else? And what does it mean to be matir asmo lemita because you left the city? Right, so I don't know the answer. John, what do you want to say?
It's not entirely clear to me that the phrase of Matir Atzmo Lemita doesn't just mean that by virtue of my actions slash whatever was the case of acceptance of Asra, I put myself in a situation where I can now be killed. Right? Meaning it's not, right, the assumption that Matir means that I have now permitted myself, right, to be killed, rather than by putting myself in the situation I have made it Mutter to kill me. Right, it's not clear to me in any of the circumstances that that's not what it means. And even by Hasra, while Hasra is difficult to construe that because of the formulation of Amenasken and Yosef, if you look at in other Rishonim, right, meaning that phrase comes up, right, Matar Atzmo Lemita, even by Rabbi Yosef Yehuda, right, where it's clearly a practical issue of Acham Yishok Mimezid, and right there the situation, right, and there, right, there's no acceptance. It really is that by virtue of your actions, it means that I'm just creating a scenario which is going to kill me. And if you understand, and even in Amenasken and Ayosa, you can construe it as the only type of crime that can be punished in court is one that is actively rebellious. And only when I verbalize Amenasken and Ayosa is it an act of rebellion such that it's mutter to be punished in medicine. But not that matir asmo lemita means I have to give permission to kill me.
Isn't it tautologous, though? Right? I don't even make any statements of the form. When you commit a capital crime, then you can be executed because you have committed a capital crime.
Yeah.
So who needs the last phrase?
And yet, that almost seems what it's like.
Okay, that's my problem with it. Right? The Rambam says, right, you can kill him because he's chayiv misa, because he was matir asmo lemita.
Which is what the Gemara says. I mean, that's the one. That's the only case that the Rambam isn't making it up. Is the Gemara, is that case, Hasra, right, the hot...
No, I'm talking about Rodesh. I'm putting Rodesh here.
Rodesh
here, right, if Beishu mitchayed benachsho, shekevan shirada, hitirat belamita.
Right.
So what's the... Right, that's what mitchayed benachsho means, according to you.
Right, I mean, by becoming a Rodesh, yeah, he's
right, so it's all, right, it's unnecessary. He could have just said, mitchayed benachsho, kevan shirada. It seems to make the rhetoric meaningless if you reduce it to that. Okay, if you're willing to lose that price, lose that price. I have trouble with that literally. Okay, yes, Rob, and then Ron.
Is it possible, I'm kind of going a bit out on a limb here, but is it possible that Matir and Hasra are linguistically related?
I'm tempted, but I don't know how.
In which case, Matir Atzmo Lemita could be, I have accepted the Hasra.
Except the problem is in the two cases, by Goel Adam, what's Hasra?
There is no
Hasra. No. It's saying that you don't need Hasra because it's as if you have received Hasra when you say.
But then there would be no Ashriyati Atzmo Lemita in the case where they're talking about Hasra.
No, in the case where they're talking about Hasra, there is Hasra. And so therefore you've accepted the Hasra.
I'm tempted. I don't think it's going to work in the end. I'm tempted. Let's see if you can come with a consistent... I tend to, it's awfully suspicious that they show up. But I don't know what have a way to make it make sense. So
I mean, you don't think this works?
I don't.
What's the intended form of to give Hasra off?
That's true. All I can say is I'm tempted, right? I think grammatically it's a push, but I'm not a big believer in grammar. Just a little bit, yeah. I thought of it. I was tested by it. I didn't go there. I'm happy to have you bring it up. If you can make it more solid, I would love it.
Okay.
Okay, right about my first dilemma.
If someone kills him, he can't claim בשמיים או באופן כללי that הוא לא רצה שהרגו אותו, הוא לא הסכים שהרגו אותו. זאת אומרת, he has no right to claim to I didn't give the permission to anyone.
And why do we care? מה הרצה שלא
הוא יודע? העם אומר לך, be aware if you do that, that you can't claim after being killed or if someone intends to kill you, you can't claim you don't have permission, לא תרצח and something like that.
זאת אומרת, איבדת
את הזכות לטעון
שאי אפשר להרוג אותך. זה הכוונה. You think the Rambam is addressing the victim and saying, right, this explains to you why it is you were killed, not explains to us why we can kill you. אז מה זה משנה אם הוא הסכים או לא? אם חייב עלינו להרגו, אז אף אם הוא לא מסכים.
אני אצמצם את מה שאמרתי. אני חושב שאחד הממדים ואחת הסיבות לכתוב דבר כזה הוא כדי לידע את האנשים שנמצאים אחת הסיבות, את האנשים שנמצאים במצב כזה שהם מאבדים את הזכות שלהם
לביטחון. Yeah, right. So you think this is directed towards a potential criminal, not towards the courts.
במובן מסוים, לא רק, אבל במובן מסוים כן.
Okay, I'm not sure I can miss by that literally either. I think that we have three different readings that are possible. Right? Jonathan wants to argue it means nothing fundamentally, and Rob wants to argue that it means hasra in a different sense, and you want to argue that it's just telling you that you have no claim, although in Hakanami, even if you had a claim, we would still do it. So, if it does, it's saying to the victim that you can't claim after that, but if you don't claim before that the victim is important, then it's based on the hanakha. שמד יש חשיב, שמד יש אסור להרוג אותו אלא אם כן הוא מסכים. שאם לא כן, אז מה זה משנה לנו אם הוא הסכים או לא?
ומה נפשך? אם מסכים או לא מסכים?
לא הבנתי
את הקושי.
אני לא, אתה אומר שהרמב"ם כתב כך כדי שהרצחן, כשהוא בא לשמיים, אי אפשר לטעון שהרגו אותי בלי צדק. אז מדוע, אז האם זה, לו זה לא היה נכון, כן? באמת לא הצהיר עצמו למיטה, לא הסכים. האם היה אסור להרגו?
אסור היה להרוג.
מדוע?
כי במצב כזה ההלכה לא הייתה קובעת ש...
מדוע? מדוע ההסכמה שלו משנה? מה ההסכמה שלו משנה? אם לא שאדם בא על עצמו וכל ההשלכות האלה. והטענה שאנחנו מעוניינים בהסכמת הרצחן, זה יוצא מתוך הנחה שההסכמה נוגע, שההסכמה חשוב בעניין הרגעה. וזה הולך יחד עם השיטה של רבי ישראלי שאדם באמת בעל על עצמו. כן, אז אני חושב שהקריאה שלך זה באמת הולך, זה מתאים למה שרבי ישראלי אומר, שבאמת אדם בעל על עצמו, באופן משמעותי.
אוקיי,
יפה.
Sure. Okay,
so that's... So let's wrap up. I'm sorry, I don't seem to have had the dynamics. Maybe we're all a little burnt out right now. Here's the way I want to wrap it up. The Machloket Rav Zevin and Rav Yisraeli is about a lot more than whether you are entitled to self-wound. Right? It's about broad, right? It's not like they have a minor machloket about that and then people build philosophic reflections off it. They really have fundamental philosophic disputes. They have a dispute about the nature of humanity. They have a dispute about the nature of Torah. Right? They have a dispute about the models of society, about politics. Right? You have disputes min ha-kotzeh v'yala kotzeh. It would be hard for Rav Dessler to say that there was no machloket between them. right, it would be hard. On the other hand, we should say that Rav that Rav Yisraeli and Rav Zevin saw each other as engaged in the same universe and participating in a discourse. As much as we are, as much as to us these gaps appear enormous, to them they were certainly well within the boundaries of Eilu Devarei Kim Chaim. Right? Even as Rav Zevin says, Rav Yisraeli says things Rav Zevin thinks he couldn't conceive of anyone having said. Right? It's not, you know, it's still UDD, and they haven't, right, they haven't gotten to the point. Right, it's the story that Rahel Scott said, right, where Rav Amital meets Rav Shach at a wedding, and Rav Shach tells him that we are now so far apart we can't even argue. Right, there's no common, right, there's no common ground for arguing. So that in itself is, that in itself is interesting. Now the question to me is, if it turns out that Dr. Steinberg is correct, that the, that one's position on informed consent is, right, depends on whether one adopts Rav Yisraeli or Rav Zevin's position. And so how do we make that decision?
I don't think Dr. Steinberg made it. I think Dr. Steinberg says you should be against informed consent regardless.
No, he says it's fine because of that, because of...
He says we don't own our body. We'll acknowledge that there is a machloket between Rav Zevin and Rav Yisraeli whether we don't own our body all or whether we own it and should do it with God. He doesn't mention the whole thing about the distinction between the Jews and non-Jews. He's assuming just Rav Yisraeli's position by Jews, and because God is at least a partner in ownership, it should still be against informed consent.
I'm not sure that's true. How do we know that your duties to God override your duties, right? The doctor's duties to God override the doctor's duties to you. I'm not sure. The interesting question, how it functions in terms of shitzvah.
That might be a plausible case. I don't think that's what Dr. Steinberg was saying. I think Dr. Steinberg was saying my argument works for both of them.
Read the footnote. Let's see. So we should frame it differently. Dr. Steinberg believes that even according to Rav Yisraeli's position, that informed consent would not be required. David points out correctly that this is only true of Rav Yisraeli's position regarding Jews. It is not true of Rav Yisraeli's position regarding non-Jews, which Dr. Steinberg doesn't mention. I think that he's probably overstating anyway, because according to Rav Yisraeli's position, even for Jews, right, you know, the existence of the fact that I can negotiate away my right to live makes it hard. Right, it's hard for me in that context to believe that he would say, but other people can impose healing on you against your will because you have an absolute obligation to live. Right, I could tell the person.
Right to be vocal on God's side,
so.
There's real shit, but
Jews.
Make a decision.
Jews don't. You're right. Okay. It might be that for Jews or Israelis is fine with it. And the only issue is only non-Jews. Might be. That's right, since he still has a prohibition against suicide. Although Jews can also, I mean, you have to be careful. Haley thinks that Jews can also fall under Dilma Machlufadina. Right, so we can negotiate.
No, even Rabbi Israeli adds the caveat that for Jews, only if you're higher Mitzvah Shemayim does it work.
Well, yes and no, because you can negotiate the terms of Marid and Malchus independently. So you can create new things which make you higher Mitzvah Shemayim. So I'm not so sure. Okay,
all right, Tarifian. So we can go there, what God convicts us for.
Okay, Tarifian. How will that work? So let's try to sum it up one more time and more effectively this time. So what I want to say is that again, the Israeli and Zevin have a huge dispute. The Israeli position at least opens up the possibility, that's a better way of framing it, that it's not so obvious that you don't have autonomy over your body, and that actually
other right, your right to autonomy over your body overrides other people's obligation to heal, and maybe over and maybe there isn't such a strong obligation on yourself to heal. But you also have to figure out the question of when we talk about what we want to say about informed consent, do we want to say something that is relevant to contemporary medical practice, that is relevant to doctors who treat both Jews and non-Jews? And how do we relate to when it if it turns out that some, at least some of the conceptions in the halachic tradition are grounded in claims of ontological differences between Jews and non-Jews that make us uncomfortable, right? What is our attitude towards such precedents? Right, do we say who cares? Do we say that we're uncomfortable? We'll quote it as a svara but not as authority? Do we say as long as we think the positions are separable, we're comfortable quoting both of them? Do we say we have no issues with ontological differences between Jews and non-Jews? Even if we have issues with this particular formulation that non-Jews are completely gashmi and Jews are gashmi and ruchani, we have other ways of making the formulation that make ourselves happy. We can come up with ground the same distinction in non-ontological terms, which David wants to do, which is that kinyan is unrelated to ontology. Right, it's just a function of history. Those are all moves we want to make. And then I think that the broader question of whether halakha is supposed to govern everything, or whether halakha just governs the spaces which are not l'skam, is part of that conversation, right? Because if your vision is that halakha is everything, then you can say to yourself, you know what? So it doesn't matter to me so much if I don't influence the conversation. So what? And only two possibilities: is halakha and not halakha. And when it's not halakha, right? Why should I care? The alternative position is the halakha, right? Is that really under most circumstances the purpose of Torah is to guide us to make proper social contracts. Now, in a society where everyone accepts the authority of Torah, we can make social contracts that are entirely in accordance with Torah. And in a society which is only partially built grounded in Torah, then our job is to make the social contract that most accords with Torah. Right, and then we have a very different ambition to engage in the conversation. Right, there is an analogy to this. That was an analogy and a caution in this regard. You might think that if you take the second position, the goal is to make the social contract that is most in accord with Torah, that the way to do that is to get the most details of Torah into the social contract that are possible. Okay? Right, so for example, I might think if I'm trying to build a constitution for the state of Israel, so I try and win the things I can win. So one of the things I win is it turns out that there isn't really much opposition to banning Shabbos. Right? Right, we don't have, right, you know, there isn't much of a state of a domestic linen market. There is a great deal of domestic wool market. If we ban shatnez, we will actually strengthen the internal wool industry because Turkish wool has shatnez in it. So I hope none of you bought talitim from a particular Hasidic group that it was unfortunately buying completely shatnez talitot from Turkey, because 100% Turkish wool talitot apparently are not quite 100% Turkish wool talitot, at least in some circumstances. So you might think that that's the goal. The goal is to get in as many details as possible. That's one position. This is the position usually attributed to Justice Amon. Justice Amon Supreme Court, right? That's what he said, right? So he put in his big thing in Israeli law was he put in a rule which said that you can go to Jewish law to resolve issues whenever there is something not covered by the seven other systems that governed Israeli law at that time, British Mandate and Jordanian and whatever else there was. And and he looked for the opportunity, so I'm told, to find a way to stick a piece of halakha in wherever he could. The contrary position, and this I owe to Rabbi Broid, although I think it's not his position, but Rabbi Broid was the one who first explained this to me, is that actually halakha is the holistic system, and putting in pieces of halakha with the other pieces, right, is silly. Because it's intended to function together. Right? It's like putting in a rule that only Congress can declare war without putting in a rule that requires the Congress. Right, it doesn't work very right. It doesn't work very well. So all four pieces of halacha are supposed to function that way. We're stuck with this, right? Yeah, the halacha is yachloku bishvua in a society, but then you don't allow a shvua. Right, that's right. That works. We use it effectively in some contexts, right? Where we use the mechanism of halakha to create results where we manipulate the environment. That's heteriska, right? Heteriska is built on a situation where we require you to take a shvua in order to, and then we don't allow you to take the shvua, right? And that's what generates the capacity to. We don't let you. We don't trust that. We don't let anybody take shvuas anymore. Right? That's basically what, at least one easy mechanism of heteriska is that. You agree that we assume the income is 10% unless you take a shua of the income is less than 10%, but we don't let you take the shua. Now the income is 10%.
We shua, at least in the RPA we use shua on the interest and adim on the principal. So
okay.
We can plausibly bring adim.
Okay. I don't know how they got it that one. Okay, so that's the issue, right? So if you take Rabbi Breud's position, which is that halakha only makes sense holistically, and it doesn't make sense to try and put in half of halakha and without the other half, so then the way to structure a conversation about informed consent should structure a function of medical practice and all other issues is not to say how many little pieces of halakha can we get, but what are the values of the total halakhic system? And what's the best system that we can get that achieves the same thing? Even if the second best system may have no connection whatsoever to the first, right? A mashal, right? If you're getting directions on MapQuest, right? So you have the shortest route and the second shortest route. Sometimes the second shortest route is everything, right? Second shortest route is everything on the shortest route, just as one place where you take a loop instead of going straight. And sometimes it is all setting out exactly in the opposite direction. Right, because there are two routes. Right, because there are two totally separate routes to get to the same way. Right, so it's worth thinking about. Right, which kind of conversation we want to have, and then think. Right, in terms of if we want to provide guidance for people who are not living in a halakhic culture. Right, is the way to do it to say, well, look, halakha requires X specifically in a halakhic society. And you can do that half the time, do it half the time. Or do we say, no, Allah's vision of humanity is X, right? And it may be that the way to accomplish that is entirely different. I'm open to both possibilities on that. And with that, we'll end and we'll energize ourselves a bit tomorrow, I guess. I know it's been a very, very long week, and...